This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Many of us have wondered what our parents were like before we were born. Sam Friedman had a particular reason he wanted to learn more about his mother's life. She died relatively young, at the age of 50, of breast cancer, when Friedman was in college. Just as he had moved away from home, his mother's sickness pulled him back in, and he resisted. He's felt guilty ever since. When he reached the age that she was when she got sick, he recognized his need to learn more about who she was. Friedman is a journalist and a professor of journalism at Columbia University. He used his journalistic skills to uncover his mother's story. He's written several books, including Jew vs. Jew, The Struggle for American Jewry, which won the National Jewish Book Award for Nonfiction in 2001. Let's start with a reading from his new book, Who She Was, My Search for My Mother's Life.
I came home for the summer, and in some ways the summer of 1974 never has ended for me. It seared into my brain the sight of a broken woman, depleted, defeated, desiccated, to whom, as a loyal son, I was shackled. It seared into my brain every guilty effort I'd made at escape, especially that day on the Wisconsin campus when I pretended not to know her. In the years since, friends have told me that I judged myself too harshly. They've told me any mother would have understood a teenaged son's display of emancipation. As a parent myself, I could accept these explanations at a cerebral level. In my soul, though, I still carried the stain. All those friends who had offered me reassurance, no, expiation, had grown into adulthood with mothers still alive and available for reconciliation. I stood frozen in the posture of rejection, frozen by my mother's early death, the eternal punctuation. As I beheld her grave in December of 2000, I wanted so fiercely to know who else she had been. I wanted to know about the family and the home and the neighborhood and the world in which she had grown. What did it mean to have come of age during the Depression, World War II, the Holocaust? I no longer could settle for the routine answers. We were poor, but everybody was poor. Bubby lost her whole family in the war. What did those giant forces that shook a planet, mean to my own mother? How did they shape her or misshape her? I harbored no desire for cheap sentimentality or easy solace, but neither did I seek a bill of indictment, a lurid litany of dysfunction. The questions that seized me were of a more quotidian sort. Who was my mother before she became my mother? Whom did she love? Who broke her heart? What lifted her dreams? What crushed her spirit? What did she want to be? And did she ever get to be it in her brief time on earth?
That's Sam Friedman reading from his new book, Who She Was, My Search for My Mother's Life. Your mother died when you were in college, and one of the reasons why it was so important for you to write about her is that you felt you pushed her out of your life when she was dying. She died at a time when you were establishing your independence, as young people do when they go to out-of-town college. And some people are even, you know, some young people are almost embarrassed to be seen with their parents because they see themselves as being so different. And you write about an experience where your mother came to visit you in college during your freshman year. And what happened?
She came out to visit, and I had resisted the idea that she would visit. In fact, my father played the interceding role he often did in really bringing home to me that this might be the only time she'd get to visit me at college before she would die. And so I consented, but I tried to set up all these ground rules, one of which was she had wanted to come to my favorite comp lit class. They had this extraordinary professor whom I told her about in my letters home. So, okay, I said, you can come to the class, but you have to sit a few rows away from me in the lecture hall, so no one will know you're my mother and I'm the kind of dependent boy who needs his mommy visiting him at college. And when class is over, we're going to walk out as if we don't know each other. And in a block or two up the street, after the rest of the students have scattered, then we can acknowledge one another. And that experience just has haunted me all these years. And again, at one level, I can see that it's all very explicable and normal. And in another way, it just feels like this unresolved sin over the years and something that I needed to redress, partly by writing this book and by doing all the research into her life that went into it.
Part of the story you tell about your mother is who she was as a sexual person. And, you know, a lot of children just can't imagine their parents as sexual creatures. And you not only had to imagine it, you had to report on it as part of her story and to talk to people who would be reliable witnesses about it, including old boyfriends. Can you talk a little bit about approaching that as an interview subject?
Sure. I actually thought that looking at her experience as a woman, her desires, to some extent her experiences as a sexual person, was part of really knowing who she was. Because, again, even as a kid, looking at her as my mother, it was clear that she was proud of her appearance. She was vain about it. She wanted to be alluring. And that was a very life-affirming thing for her, almost in a tragic sense, because at a point very early in her breast cancer, when it might have been arrested forever if she had had a mastectomy, she wouldn't do it because she just could not bear the idea of losing her breast. She would say, I will not be disfigured. I will not be mutilated. So her feeling of herself as a attractive person was key to her, essential to her. And it was also really part of getting a hold of how she fit in with her times, because the book is not only about her individually and even about her family, but about this period from the late 30s to the early 50s. And the code of sexual conduct was such a huge part of the life her girlfriends and the boys she dated and the boys she knew lived within. And she was a rebel, or wanted to be a rebel against that. She was straining in her life against the code that says, if you go to bed with someone, you've gone from being a good girl to being a bad girl, and then no one will marry you. It changes your status irrevocably. And this was a zone of behavior that I think not only frustrated her tremendously, but confounded a lot of the boys she knew as well. A couple of them, as I would, you know, talk about their dates, would talk about times when they'd come back from a date, and maybe my mother, in one case, had had a little too much to drink, and so her guard was really down, and would be pulling her boyfriend down onto the couch of her parents' darkened apartment, hoping that he would go all the way with her. And the boy would find it impossible to do that, partly for the sense that you're taking advantage of someone who's a little bit high, but more importantly, because boys were told, if she gives in to you, then you can't marry her. Then she's no good anymore. And that whole part of her life and of the life of her contemporaries was, you know, integral to the book and absolutely integral to her character. And I think, you know, I'm 50 years old. I'm grown up enough to look at what her life has been in all of its ramifications. And I think, again, it's part of looking at the vigor she brought to the brief life she had to know that she felt desire.
You learn that there was a man she fell in love with as a young woman who she wanted to marry but didn't. This man wasn't Jewish. His name was Charlie Greco. And her mother, your grandmother, was so upset at the thought of her daughter marrying someone who wasn't Jewish that she threatened to throw herself off the roof. And your mother very resentfully decided to stop seeing this man because her mother had threatened suicide. First of all, how did you discover this? I don't think you knew about this relationship until you started researching the book.
Well, I had heard little stray mentions growing up to a few parts of my mother's life. These were never elaborated on. But one of the things I'd heard is that my mother had had a non-Jewish boyfriend and that my grandmother had threatened to jump off the roof to object to it. But hearing that, it was hard to know, was this just sort of a family fable, an exaggeration? What was really behind it? And I never knew the entirety of what was behind it until doing all the work on the book. And then it became an incredibly dense and textured story in which, in some ways, I discovered just how incredibly small-minded my grandmother could be, you know, putting her own life on the line to deprive my mother of someone she loved deeply and someone who loved her and someone who, although he was Italian Catholic, was absolutely fascinated with and infatuated with all things Jewish. But it also revealed to me a whole other side of the story, which was that what my grandmother, in a very wrong-headed way, was acting out was also this very real grief over the death of almost all of her family members in the Holocaust. And she could only interpret that as being not the Nazis killed my family, not the Germans killed my family, but the Gentiles killed my family. And she even used the derogatory Yiddish term, goys. The goys killed my family. And at the same time, I felt empathy for my grandmother that I had never felt before, because now I also knew how for a period of years she'd been scraping together what little money the family had during the Depression to try to send to her relatives, sending them clothing that they could use, that they could try to sell or barter, doing anything to get them out. And in fact, the only relatives who got out of Poland, who ended up in South America, got out through her efforts. And yet she felt herself complicit and responsible for their extermination. But I suppose finding that feeling unbearable, she had to put it on someone else, and she put it on my mother and my mother's boyfriend, Charlie.
My guest is Sam Friedman. His new book, Who She Was, is the story of his mother's life before he was born. When we left off, Friedman was explaining that when his mother was young, she was in love with a man who wasn't Jewish, but she broke things off when her mother threatened to throw herself off the roof if they got married. One of the people you interviewed for the book was the woman who this man married after your mother broke off the relationship. And he's long dead, but you interviewed his widow. And I've thought a lot about what it must have been like to talk with her about the woman her husband was in love with shortly before he met the woman who you were interviewing.
It went into some really tender, difficult territory, and I was always incredibly grateful that Charlie's widow would even see me, and not only see me, but she helped me locate Charlie's one living sibling, a sister, and a bunch of his closest friends growing up. And they were actually the ones who remembered my mother and Charlie together. They were the ones who went on dates with them and remembered when my mother was over at Charlie's family's house for Christmas Eve. Charlie's widow, Selma, I was talking to her mostly about Charlie himself, because she came into Charlie's life after the relationship with my mother had broken up. And, you know, when she first met Charlie, he was still really, you know, kind of distraught over the breakup with my mother. And in fact, initially had said to Selma, the woman who'd ultimately married, that he was still with my mother, which was not true. And then he, you know, soon after that acknowledged they had already broken up. So my mother's relationship with Charlie was certainly something hovering over, you know, over Charlie's marriage. But I suppose one of the reasons that she did speak to me is that in the end, Charlie did marry her, and Charlie did have a family with her. And there's even a point late in the book, after my mother's disastrous first marriage has been annulled, and before she's decided to marry my father, when she even calls up Charlie, who by this time has a family, and says, you know, now I'm ready to marry you. And Charlie says to her, you know, I'm married, I have children, and I'm not going to leave my family. And so I suppose that knowing that probably makes it a little bit more possible for Charlie's then wife, now widow, to revisit some of this territory.
Did he tell her about that experience?
He did. He, what happened was she had arranged to call him at a telephone booth outside a convenience store near his house. And Selma happened to be driving by in her car when she saw Charlie on the phone. And then when he got home a little bit later, she said, you know, why are you making a phone call, you know, a couple of blocks from home? And he said, well, that was Eleanor. And he explained the substance of the conversation. And when Selma told me this story, I thought, it's amazing, and it sounds true. So the next time I went to see my aunt, my mother's sister, I said to her, you know, I heard this story from Charlie's widow about mom calling up Charlie after she got the annulment and asking if he would leave his family so they could marry. And my aunt said, yes, I remember that.
You are a professor of journalism at the Columbia School of Journalism. You teach a class on book writing, on nonfiction book writing. And several of your students have gone on to write books, and several of those books have been memoirs. I'd like to hear what you think makes a life worth writing about. You've written several nonfiction books, and they've all been about other people, a teacher, a preacher, three families. Let's face it, like your mother, who this book is about, she's not a person we would read about because she's famous, because she wasn't famous. We wouldn't read about her because of her extraordinary accomplishments, because she didn't have extraordinary accomplishments. So what makes a person worth reading about?
You know, the thing that links this book to almost everything else I've written is this idea that I hold really ferociously, that quote-unquote ordinary lives can actually be quite extraordinary, not because they leave behind these incredible accomplishments, but because any life really explored by a writer is filled with all the passionate elements of human nature, with love, with disappointment, with longing, with anger. Those are like the, on the periodic chart of the elements, these are like the basic elements of human existence, and they can be in any life. And I suppose also because I felt almost generationally I was speaking to other people who were hitting middle age as I was, and maybe their parents were alive, but their parents were probably in their 70s or 80s. And these people, like me, were maybe realizing for the first time, I don't even really know who my parents are, other than the fact that they're my parents. But you know what? They must have had times when they were in love with people who didn't love them back, or vice versa. They must have had times when they were scrambling to help their family get by in the Depression. So maybe it spoke to a generational part.
I think one reason why so many people are interested in learning more about the lives of their parents is, you know, we're all mysteries unto ourselves in some way. Like, we don't really understand why we're made the way we are, or why our emotional systems work the way they do. And I think we feel like, well, if we understood more about our parents, we'd maybe understand more about ourselves. So do you feel like you had any major revelations about how you're made, what your emotional makeup is like, by getting a sense of your mother and your grandmother's history?
Absolutely. It also, of course, complicates what you know about with your parents. You know, in writing about my mother's dating life and love life, I've seen really clearly the type of man she liked. It's a through line that runs through all of her serious relationships, including her marriage to my father, with the exception of the marriage that got annulled. And I see that I'm not that type, that I was more like these sort of nerdy kids who were her friends in high school, the boy she was friendly with, but not the kind like my father to whom she responded. But all of it, I feel like, is worth knowing. And just one last point on that is, in a more communal way, having grown up and heard these vague references to the relatives who got killed in the Holocaust, I went to great efforts to find out that story, which went to Poland and to Uruguay, and it involved my grandmother's life in New York, and finally put together this really incredibly tragic but very, to me, personal story of what happened to my own flesh and blood. And that was a really, you know, edifying, important thing to know, because it takes this abstraction of history and makes it feel very palpable.
In the beginning of our interview, we talked about the incident in which your mother wanted to come and sit in on one of your classes, and you made her act like she didn't know you so that none of the other students would know that your mom was in class with you. And you felt very guilty about that over the years, and that's like part of the reason why you wanted to, you know, write this book and understand who she was. And so, but did the book help in that? Do you feel like over that incident now?
I do finally feel over that incident. I feel that I made good some kind of a psychic debt to her with all the effort it took to reconstruct her life and with all of the emotional connection that I came to feel to her in doing it. It was a way of apologizing, I guess, apologizing for that day, apologizing for the long, unconscionable absence from her grave. I could only pay her back in, I guess, what's the currency of my world or my way of life, which is research and writing and telling a story.
Sam Friedman, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you, Terry. It was such a pleasure.
Sam Friedman's new book is called Who She Was. He's a professor of journalism at Columbia University.